So I walked downstairs this morning, and I realized I was wearing all black. So if I look like a disembodied head, I apologize. Sorry, Brad. So I know that I said it was going to be the Can the Feminine Save Us? But, you know, I feel like the women who've come before me have done such a good job of reminding us that we need both the masculine and the feminine that the question was too easy. So, as we approach the end of March and we wrap our series, Your Wild and Precious Life, I decided I'm going to call the talk Bodies, 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 because they inspired me so much. To be honest, this talk has gone through a few iterations. I'm standing by my quotes that are in the bulletin. There's some great spicy stuff in there. But my slightly sarcastic newsletter comments about gender roles, politics, COVID, and world peace are no longer so interesting to me. What I really want to talk about today are bodies. This is kind of a joke because that Bodies, Bodies, Bodies is the name of what?
A movie.
It's a horror film written in 2022. It came out in 2022, and it's directed by a woman. And we're actually going to talk a little bit more about horror films and women in just a second. But before we dive in, and especially for those that are new to the conversation surrounding the feminine, I want to be clear what I mean when I say the feminine. Brad used a lovely Mirabai Star quote in one of his emails recently that frames the conversation well. Star says, when I say feminine, I'm not speaking about gender. I'm speaking about a spirit, a mode of soul that belongs to all of us, to people of all genders. Masculine and feminine energies exist in everyone, and talking about the feminine is relevant to all of us. All right, so here we go. I love stories. I think that the stories that we tell are not only ways to teach and entertain ourselves, but the very best stories tap into our most real and subconscious wonderings. I see movies and television as a kind of cultural therapy session. It's the way that we let out the psychological stuff that's going inside of our heads and our bodies. This magical love and obsession of stories is very helpful at the gym. Anything I can do to distract myself from my body's stress while running is a thumbs up. I have many, many gifts, I think, but the divine creator or evolution did not give me a runner's body. So my Planet Fitness has this secret upstairs level with a string of treadmills and a wall of televisions. And all of the televisions reliably play the same early 2000s television reruns every day. I watch Charmed, Reba, and Cold Case, sometimes all at the same time. And if you miss a day, it doesn't even really matter. Does anyone remember these shows? Okay. Across the board, all of the leading actresses are women. They're tapping into power, ownership, their intuition. They fight for their family and their friends. And everyone looks 1990s great while doing it. Last week, Beth said that our culture often limits women to three most common archetypes: the maiden, the mother, and the lover. And I would agree. Those feel like the safest stories to publicly inhabit. But watching these shows, I was suddenly struck by what the television was saying 25 years ago when I was a formative teenager. All three shows embraced different, less common aspects of the feminine. I looked up these shows, and guess what? All of the writers are women, not men. But that's, I mean, it's like, they were all women. I was surprised. I did not know that before I looked it up. So 2 weeks ago, Sarah Kornfield quoted, I'm going to try to say her name, Elena Sixous's work. Sixous calls for women to write themselves, Kornfield said. Sixous encouraged women to express themselves freely from their own perspective, challenging the male-dominated discourse that silences them. And I want to say that it's happening. I think women are trying to share their stories, and something lingering in those stories about what it means to be a fuller woman is lingering in our collective culture, and that's encouraging. So with that in mind, I found something interesting last week. I'm always looking up new movies that are coming out into theaters, and one of my regular movie review websites had an interesting article out. In honor of Women's History Month and the Oscars, which happened at the beginning of March, someone put together a list of the best horror films directed by women. I am not a lover of horror films, but I started to scroll through this list, and I quickly realized that the films had a strange pattern. Many, if not most of the films dealt in some way with physical or body horror, pregnancy, family grief, either partners or children, or sexuality gone awry. My spidey sense went off. I felt the cultural psychology coming out. These women-directed films are movies about primal feminine fear. And many of these fears are not cerebral. These films are about the body. With this, again, Sarah Kornfield's words came to mind. She said, "The Christian tradition has often associated women with the body, with nature, with a sort of primitive or animalistic emotional state. Meanwhile, men are associated with rationality, order, the mind. This means that in much of Western Christian thought, women's bodies have been considered conduits of sin." So I want to run with this for a while. While the masculine and the feminine energies are not actually split between the mind and the body, in broad generalizations, the masculine is associated with being in the head and the feminine as being in the body. So is everyone willing to go with me with these two dichotomies for a while? All right, I want to start with male and female bodies. After humans pushed their way through the convoluted horrors of adolescence and puberty, hormones often send biological males and biological females in two slightly different directions. To talk about hormonal changes, I'm going to use the weather and geography. I imagine the male body and the movement of hormones beyond puberty as equivalent to living in Southern California. There, the weather, aka hormones, is relatively reliable. The daily high throughout the year is between 68 and 85 degrees. It's usually sunny. Yes, there are some rainy periods, but there's an expectation that things will stay relatively constant. The female hormonal body is like living in the Midwest. There are seasons every month after puberty. Women navigate their cycles. They are aware of the months for 30 to 40 years. And then they face menopause, which is a complete dismantling of the entire hormonal machine. It's like a snowstorm in April and often inconvenient. These are gross generalizations, of course, but the feeling of time passing, of seasons, makes a difference. I count my days and my months. I pay attention to the passing of time because my body demands that I do. It's hard to ignore. And this doesn't even take pregnancy and birth into account. It is a bizarre experience to grow another person in your body. At least I was able to do it in a Western hospital in the comfort of relative safety. Across the globe, a woman dies every 2 minutes due to pregnancy and childbirth. Lucy Jones, an English science and nature journalist, just wrote a book called Matrescence, which is a relatively new word referring to the process of becoming a mother. Jones writes about her own experience of having a child. She says, "I thought early motherhood would be gentle, beatific, pacific, tranquil, bathed in a soft light. But actually, it was hardcore, edgy, gnarly. It wasn't pale pink. It was brown of shit and red of blood, and it was the most political experience of my life, rife with conflict, domination, drama, struggle, and power. For myself, I remember during the birth of at least one of my kids thinking, I think I might die because of this." Jones talks about the cultural obsession with natural birth. For those who don't know, natural birth refers to the process of delivering a baby vaginally without the use of medical interventions such as epidurals or pain medications. This is like a big deal. And the literature or websites will tell you that it's the best way for your baby to be born. Jones says, perhaps the cultural obsession with natural birth reflects the extent of our detachment from our bodies and from the earth. We are so disconnected from the rest of the natural world that we don't know what nature is. Bodies failing, cuckoos pushing eggs out of nests, a weirdly small human pelvis and a big infant head, illness and disease, shit and blood, ticks and cockroaches. Natural childbirth in the natural world often ends in infant or maternal death. I don't think that the traditional fear of the body is strictly isolated to a fear of sex and sin. This is a new and a growing suspicion for me, but I wonder if women's bodies generally require women to watch time pass differently than men's bodies do. We are afraid of our bodies, our powerful, broken, mortal bodies. You would not be here without your body, whatever state it is in. I think that the changes that women experience, periods, pregnancy, birth, menopause, are a fast track to remind us of our impending death. As Mark said during Talk Back, our bodies are messengers, and I think that's true. It's time to dive into our first quote from the great church father, St. Augustine. It's on your bulletins. I don't see what sort of help woman was created to provide man with, if one excludes the purpose of procreation. If woman was not given to man for help in bearing child, for what help could she be? To till the earth together, if help were needed for that, man would have been a better help for man. The same goes for comfort in solitude. How much more pleasure is it for life and conversation when two friends live together than when a man and a woman cohabitate? Thank you, Augustine. The quote is obviously insulting, but when viewed through the lens of balance and the body, I think what's more striking is that Augustine is missing the point of being human. When we avoid our bodies, the reality of our flesh, our egos, our brains can pretend that we are immortal. Augustine's statement reeks of the overhyped masculine by which the mind and logic and rationality are all that there is. Unchecked, an over-masculine figure might believe themselves to be an immortal god, something most wisdom traditions generally don't encourage. This is not the way we need to see logic and rationality. Memento mori is a Latin phrase that means remember, you will die. It dates back to Socrates, who said that the proper place to practice philosophy is about nothing else but dying and being dead. In balance, aspects of the feminine, body, nature, a kind of animalistic emotional state, gives perspective to rationality, order, and the mind. What we need is syzygy, for our mind and our body to be in alignment, for the masculine and the feminine to work together. I'm going to flip everything around now. I know we've been splitting the masculine and the feminine between mind and body. As I said at the beginning, that's not really how the masculine and the feminine are split. In reality, the body itself is made up of the masculine and the feminine. According to Shaivism, a prominent branch of yogic philosophy, there exists a divine masculine energy embodied by the Hindu god Lord Shiva, and a divine feminine energy embodied by the goddess Shakti. Traditionally, it is believed that our left side represents our feminine nature, while the right side represents our masculine nature. These energies of Shiva and Shakti coexist within each human being, and when they unite, they bring about a state of complete balance, joy, and presence. My favorite biological part of all of this is that our brains have contralateral control. That means that the brain's hemispheres are responsible for controlling the opposite side of the body. Neurologically speaking, the right side of the brain controls the left side of our body, and the left side of the brain innervates the right side of our body. And even now, no one really knows why the brain is crisscrossed. While the left and right hemispheres have distinct functions, they work together and they're not completely isolated. It's biologically brilliant. Finding balance doesn't stop with the individual. The balance leaks out into our communities. We are dependent on each other. Scott Gilbert is an American evolutionary developmental biologist and a historian of biology. He's the author of the second quote in our bulletins today. He says, 21st century biology is fundamentally different from 20th century biology. It is a biology of relationships rather than entities. The biology of anatomic individualism that has been the basis of genetics, anatomy, physiology, evolution, developmental biology, and immunology has been shown to be, at best, a weak first approximation of nature. Our over-masculinized, head-based individualism is not actually how things work. One of my personal coaches a few years back brought up the idiom, you pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Have you heard that one? It originated as a sarcastic way to describe an impossible task in the late 1800s. It is physically impossible to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Now science agrees. There are a lot of religious texts that agree with and predate Scott Gilbert. Our great spiritual and wisdom traditions have been saying this for centuries. Christianity. In Christ, we, though many, form one body, and each member belongs to all the others. Islam. People, we created you all from a single man and a single woman and made you into races and tribes so that you could recognize one another. Judaism. As iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another. Baha'i, the earth is but one country and mankind its citizens. Buddhism, the hand and other limbs are many and distinct, but all are one, the body to be kept and guarded. Likewise, different beings in their joy and sorrows are like me, all one in wanting happiness. Taoism, heaven and earth and I were born at the same time, and all life and I are one. Confucianism. Men are closer to one another by nature. They diverge as a result of repeated practice. Individually, we have a complicated body, and we make up other complicated bodies, communities. In the same way that living in balance is hard, to live in community is hard. What does balance in community look like? Alex and I have a dear friend and his wonderful girlfriend. They stayed with us for the last 2 weeks or so. We've known Ben since college. He moved to South Korea a few years after we graduated. And Ben, through a strange string of coincidences, ended up living with us for about 3 months when the lockdown happened 5 years ago. Happy COVID anniversary, everyone. Liam, my youngest, was only about 4 months old, and Alex and I had four kids in the house ages six and under, and it was chaos. But we survived, and it cemented Ben as part of our family community. So we love Ben, and also when he comes. He sleeps in the basement, so we lose about one-third of our house space and one of our two bathrooms. He generally runs late, so plans are always shifting. Alex and I stay up way too late and still have to get up very early to get the kids to school. Our eating habits get messy as Ben wants to eat all of the food he can't find back in South Korea. My trips to Planet Fitness fly out the window. And finally, the world that Ben has experienced over the last 25 years is so much different than what Alex or I have experienced. This sometimes makes for heated or misunderstood conversations. On Wednesday, this last week, Ben and his girlfriend finished gathering all of their things. After the kids had been ushered to school and Alex had left for work, my head was ready for them to go. I thought, thank goodness, I'm going to get some sleep tonight. I can have my basement back and start folding the six baskets of laundry I have waiting for me. The house is going to be quiet. But as Ben and Hani drove away from the curb, honking the horn with one last farewell, I sat down on the bench inside of our door and I started to cry. In spite all of the tension of being together, I suffered a mini death of sorts. A piece of community, complete with all of its complications, had left. And there was something in their unique themness that my soul grieved saying goodbye to. The world was a little more empty. Did having Ben around make my life easier? Nope. Had he stayed much longer than 2 weeks, I might have needed to set some clearer boundaries, embraced some of my masculine energy. But ultimately, I want for Ben what I want for myself, to be happy and whole and thriving. I want him to use his unique energy in the world to the best of his ability. Ultimately, the answer to the question, can the feminine save us, is no. To be clear, I suspect we're currently at a massive feminine deficit, but the feminine without the masculine is also lost. We need both. It's the balance that's hard. But only by balancing can we not just survive, but thrive. All right, back to your bulletins, the last quote for today. A broken family is a family in which any member must break herself into pieces to fit in. A whole family is one in which each member can bring her full self to the table, knowing that she will always be both held and free. A thriving world is one where our whole unique selves, bodies and minds, masculine and feminine, are both held and free. The body doesn't end with close friends. It's rough news. You are a biologically proven community with the people in this room and the people who voted differently from you at the last election and the people you may have left behind at a previous religious community. We know the patriarchy doesn't work, but I don't think that a world run by women is the answer, or we risk looking a lot like Augustine. As we wrap up our series on the feminine, the person I actually think the most about is Liam, my 5-year-old son. Honestly, I believe my daughters can be and do anything their hearts desire. They can be moms, presidents, teachers, actors, mechanics, nomads, whatever. If they can dream it, my heart screams, go for it. But what will the world look like for Liam? A white boy who will become a white man. Honestly, there's a level of toxic femininity that does not have space for him. What does the world tell him that he can be? I want to say anything. Father, president, teacher, actor, mechanic, nomad, whatever. If you can dream it, you can do it. I want to tell him that he can bring his full self to the table, knowing that he will be both held and free. But deep down, I can feel a bias that something about the color of his skin and his unrequested genitals is intrinsically problematic. Can the world, the feminine, hold him when his ancestors have caused so much pain and destruction? How do I help him believe that his racial and gender privilege can dance with his capacity for good in the world? What is my responsibility to him, to the greater world in raising him? How do I tell him with all my heart that he can be anything he wants to be? That is the key to honoring both his masculine and feminine beauty. How do I teach him to embrace his one wild and precious life? I'd like to close with Mary Oliver's poem, The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last, and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Thank you.